Chapter 26. The Earth Crossers. An asteroid can be any size from a man's fist to a mountain. They are the detritus of the solar system, the rubbish left over after the workmen have been and gone. Most of the asteroids around today occupy a space between Mars and Jupiter. There are millions of them, yet their combined mass is a fraction of the Earth's. Every now and then, an asteroid's orbit coincides with that of Earth. An Earth-crosser. To the Earth-crosser society, the arrival of an asteroid at a planet is the return of a lost orphan, a prodigal son. It is a matter of some consequence.
Mr. S. A. Orbiter, the Earth-crossers. Liddington Hill overlooks the RAF and later Luftwaffe airfield of Rorton. The low hill is also home to an Iron Age fort, one of several that ring the Marlborough and Lambourne Downs. The antiquity of the site, however, was not what attracted the Earthcrossers. They had gathered in almost every country of the globe, following the peculiar predictions of their calling in an apparently random fashion. They always observed the same routine. Name the site, do a very good deal with the owners for exclusivity, then move in the month before, using either local security or more junior members of the group to ensure that no infiltrators find their way in. It was perhaps due to this extreme secrecy that the militant astronomical group managed to keep what they did absolutely quiet. It seemed an almost perfect hiding place for Dr. Muller, who co-devised the society in the early 50s with Samuel Orbiter, a notable television astronomer of the time. Victor parked his car and walked nonchalantly up to two huge gorilla-sized men who were standing next to a Land Rover. Victor looked to the left and right. Every 300 yards was a group of armed security men with walkie-talkies and dogs, keeping an eye out for trespassers. There was no way on earth that anyone could slip by unseen. The best means of entering anywhere you aren't allowed to go is to walk in the front door as though you own the place.
"Afternoon," said Victor, attempting to walk past.
One of the gorillas stepped into his way and put a huge hand on his shoulder.
"Good afternoon, sir. Fine day. May I see your pass?"
"Of course," said Victor, fumbling in his pocket.
He produced the pass inserted behind the worn plastic window of his wallet. If the gorillas took it out and saw that it was a photocopy, then all would be lost.
"I haven't seen you around before, sir,"
said one of the men suspiciously.
"No," replied Victor evenly. "You'll see from my card that I belong to the Berwick-upon-Tweed spiral arm."
The first man passed the wallet to his comrade.
"We've been having problems with infiltrators. Isn't that so, Mr. Europa?"
The second man grunted and passed the wallet back to Victor.
"Name?"
asked the first, holding up a clipboard.
"I probably won't be on the list," said Victor slowly. "I'm a latecomer. I called Dr. Muller last night."
"I don't know of any Dr. Muller," said the first, sucking in air through his teeth as he looked at Victor with narrowed eyes.
"But if you are an Earth-crosser, you will have no problem telling me which of the planets has the highest density."
Victor looked from one to the other and laughed. They laughed with him.
"Of course not."
He took a step forward, but the smile on the men's faces dropped. One of them put out another massive hand to stop him.
"Well, this is preposterous," said Victor indignantly. "I've been an Earth-crosser for 30 years, and I've never had this sort of treatment before."
"We don't like infiltrators," said the first man again.
"They try to give us a bad name. Do you want to know what we do to bogus members?"
"Now, again, which of the planets has the highest density?"
Victor looked at the two men, who looked back at him menacingly.
"It's Earth. The lowest is Pluto, okay?"
The two security men were not yet convinced.
Kindergarten stuff, mister. How long is a weekend on Saturn?
2 miles away, in Bowden's car, Bowden and I were frantically calculating the answer and transmitting it down the line to the earpiece that Victor was wearing. The car was stuffed with all sorts of reference books on astronomy. All that we could hope was that none of the questions would be too obscure. 20 hours, said Bowden down the line to Victor.
About 20 hours,
said Victor to the two men.
Orbital velocity of Mercury?
Would that be aphelion or perihelion?
Don't get smart, pal. Average will do.
Let me see now. Add the two together and... Ah, good Lord! Is that a ringed chaffinch?
The two men didn't turn to look. Well?
It's, 106,000 miles per hour.
Uranus moons.
Uranus,
replied Victor, stalling for time.
Don't you think it's amusing that they changed the pronunciation?
The moons, sir. Of course. Oberon, Titania, hold it. A real Earth crosser would have logged the closest first.
Victor sighed as Bowden reversed the order over the airwaves.
Cordelia, Ophelia, Bianca, Cressida, Desdemona, Juliet, Portia, Rosalind, Belinda, Puck, Miranda, Ariel, Umbriel, Titania and Oberon.
The two men looked at Victor, nodded, and then stepped back to let him pass. Their manner changed abruptly to acute politeness.
Thank you, sir. Sorry about that, but as I'm sure you realise, there are very many people who would like to see us stopped. I'm sure you understand. Of course. And may I congratulate you on your thoroughness, gentlemen. Good day.
As Victor walked by, they stopped him again.
Aren't you forgetting something, sir?
Victor turned. I had wondered about some sort of password, and if that was what they wanted now, we were sunk. He decided to let them lead the situation.
Leave it in the car, sir,
asked the first man after a pause.
Here, borrow mine.
The security man reached inside his jacket and pulled out not a gun, as Victor expected, but a baseball catcher's glove. He smiled and handed it over.
I dare say I won't make it up there today.
Victor slapped his own forehead with the ball of his hand.
Mind like a string bag. I must have left it at home. Imagine coming to an Earthcrosser's meet and forgetting my catcher's glove.
They all laughed with him dutifully. The first guard said,
Have a good time, sir. Earthstrike is at 14:32.
He thanked them both and hopped into the waiting Land Rover before they changed their minds. He looked at the catcher's glove uneasily. What on earth were they up to? The Land Rover dropped him at the east entrance to the hill fort. He could see about 50 people milling around, all wearing steel helmets. A large tent had been set up in the centre of the fort, and it bristled with aerials and a large satellite dish. Farther up the hill was a radar scanner that revolved slowly. He had expected to see a large telescope or something, but no such apparatus seemed to have been set up.
Name?
Victor turned to see a small man staring up at him. He was holding a clipboard and wearing a steel helmet and seemed to be taking full advantage of his limited authority. Victor attempted a bluff.
That's me there,
he said, pointing at a name at the bottom of the list.
Mr. Continued Overleaf, are you?
Above that,
Victor countered hurriedly.
Mrs. Trotswell?
Ceres. Augustus Ceres.
The small man consulted his list carefully, running a steel ballpoint pen down the row of names.
No one of that name here,
he said slowly, looking at Victor suspiciously.
I'm from Berwick-upon-Tweed,
explained Victor.
Late entry. I don't suppose the news filtered through.
Dr. Muller said I could drop in any time.
The small man jumped.
Muller? There's no one here of that name. You must mean Dr. Cassiopeia.
He winked and smiled broadly.
Okay, now, he added, consulting his list and looking around the fort. We're a bit thin on the outer perimeter. You can take Station B3. Do you have a glove? Good. What about a helmet? Never mind. Here, take mine. I'll get another from stores. Earth strike at 14:32. Good day.
Victor took the helmet and wandered off in the direction that the small man had indicated.
Hear that, Thursday? He hissed. Dr. Cassiopeia.
I heard it, I replied.
We're seeing what we've got on him.
Bowden was already contacting Finisterre, who was waiting back at the Literatech office for just such a call. Victor filled his briar pipe and was walking towards Station B3 when a man in a barber jacket nearly marched straight into him. He recognized Dr. Muller's face from the mugshot immediately. Victor raised his hat, apologized, and walked on.
Wait! Yelled Muller.
Victor turned. Muller raised an eyebrow and stared at him.
Haven't I seen your face somewhere else?
No, it's always been right here on the front of my head,
replied Victor, attempting to make light of the situation. Muller simply stared at him with a blank expression as Victor carried on filling his pipe.
I've seen you somewhere before, continued Muller,
but Victor was not so easily shaken.
I don't think so, he announced, offering his arm. Ceres, he added. Berwick-upon-Tweed spiral arm.
Berwick-upon-Tweed, eh? Said Muller.
Then you know my good friend and colleague, Professor Barnes.
Never heard of him,
announced Victor, guessing that Muller was suspicious. Muller smiled and looked at his watch.
Earth strike in 7 minutes, Mr. Ceres. Perhaps you'd better take your station.
Victor lit his pipe, smiled, and walked off in the direction he had been given earlier. There was a stake in the ground marked B3, and he stood around feeling slightly stupid. All the other Earthcrossers had donned their helmets and were scanning the sky to the west. Victor looked around and caught the eye of an attractive woman of about his own age, a half dozen paces away at B2.
Hello,
he said cheerfully, tipping his helmet. The woman fluttered her eyelashes demurely.
All well? She asked.
Top hole,
returned Victor elegantly, then added quickly,
Actually not. This is my first time.
The lady smiled at him and waved her catcher's glove.
Nothing to it. Catch away from the body and keep your eyes sharp. We may get a lot or none at all, and if you do catch one, be sure to put it down on the grass straight away. After deaccelerating through the Earth's atmosphere, they tend to be a trifle hot.
Victor stared at her.
You mean we aim to catch meteors?
The lady laughed a delicious laugh.
No, no, silly. They're called meteorites. Meteors are things that burn up in Earth's atmosphere. I've been to 17 of these suspected Earth strikes since 64. I once nearly caught one in Tierra del Fuego in 71. Of course, she added more slowly, that was when dear George was still alive.
She caught his eye and smiled. Victor smiled back. She carried on.
If we witness an Earth strike today, it will be the first predicted strike in Europe to be successful. Imagine catching a meteorite, the rubble made during the creation of the universe over 4.5 billion years ago. It's like an orphan finally coming home.
Very poetic, responded Victor slowly, as I started talking in his ear by way of the wire.
There's no one listed anywhere by the name of Dr. Cassiopeia,
I told him.
For goodness sake, don't let him out of your sight.
I won't, replied Victor, looking around for Muller.
Pardon?
Asked the lady at B2, who had been eyeing him up and not staring at the sky at all.
I won't, drop one if I catch one, he replied hurriedly.
The tannoy announced the earth strike in 2 minutes. There was a murmur from the expectant crowd.
Good luck,
said the lady, giving him a broad wink and staring up into the cloudless sky. There was a voice from close behind Victor.
I do remember you.
He turned to see the very unwelcome face of Dr. Muller staring at him. A little farther on stood a burly security guard, hand at the ready in his breast pocket.
Your spec ops, Literatech. Victor Analogy, isn't it? No, the name's Dr. Augustus Ceres, Barrack upon Tweed.
Victor laughed nervously and added,
What sort of a name is Victor Analogy?
Muller beckoned to the henchman, who advanced on Victor, drawing his automatic. He looked like the sort of person who was itching to use it.
I'm sorry, my friend, said Muller kindly, but that's not really good enough. If you are Analogy, you're clearly meddling. If, however, you turn out to be Dr. Ceres from Barrack upon Tweed, then you have my sincerest apologies.
Now, wait a moment, began Victor,
but Muller interrupted.
I'll let your family know where to find the body, he said magnanimously.
Victor glanced around for possible help, but all the other Earthcrossers were staring at the sky.
Shoot him.
The henchman smiled, his finger tightening on the trigger. Victor winced as a high-pitched scream filled the air and a fortuitous incoming meteorite shattered on the henchman's helmet. He collapsed like a sack of potatoes. The gun went off and put a neat hole in Victor's baseball glove. Suddenly, the air was full of red-hot meteorites screaming to Earth in a localized shower. The assembled Earthcrossers were thrown into confusion by the sudden violence and couldn't quite make up their minds whether to avoid the meteorites or try to catch them. Muller fumbled in his jacket pocket for his own pistol as someone yelled, "Yours!" close at hand. They both turned, but it was Victor who caught the small meteorite. It was about the size of a cricket ball and was still glowing red hot. He tossed it to Muller, who instinctively caught it. Sadly, he did not have a catcher's glove. There was a hiss and a yelp as he dropped it. Then a cry of pain as Victor took the opportunity to thump him on the jaw with a speed that belied his 75 years. Muller went down like a ninepin, and Victor leaped on the dropped gun. He thrust it against Muller's neck, dragged him to his feet, and started to march him out of the hill fort. The meteorite shower was easing up as he backed out, my voice in his earpiece telling him to go easy.
It is Analogy, isn't it? Said Muller. It is. Spec Ops 27, and you're under arrest.
Victor, Bowden and I had got Muller as far as Interview Room 3 before Braxton and Schitt realized who we had captured. Victor had barely asked Muller to confirm his name before the interview room door burst open. It was Schitt, flanked by 2 SO9 operatives. None of them looked like they had a sense of humor.
My prisoner, Analogy.
My prisoner, Mr. Schitt, I think, replied Victor firmly. My collar, my jurisdiction. I am interviewing Dr. Muller about the Chuzzlewit theft.
Jack Schitt looked at Commander Hicks, who was standing behind him. The commander sighed and cleared his throat.
I'm sorry to say this, Victor, but the Goliath Corporation and their representative have been granted jurisdiction over SO-27 and SO-9 in Swindon. Withholding material from Acting Spec Ops Commander Schitt may result in criminal proceedings for concealment of vital information pertinent to an ongoing inquiry. Do you understand what this means?
It means Schitt does what he pleases, returned Victor.
Relinquish your prisoner, Victor.
The Goliath Corporation takes precedence.
Victor stared at him hotly, then pushed his way out of the interview room.
I'd like to stay, I requested.
No chance, said Schitt. An SO-27 security clearance is not permissible.
It's all well, then, I replied, that I still hold an SO-5 badge.
Jack Schitt cursed,
but said nothing more. Bowden was ordered out, and the two SO9 operatives stood either side of the door. Shit and Hicks sat down at the table behind which Muller nonchalantly smoked a cigarette. I leaned against the wall and impassively watched the proceedings.
"He'll get me out, you know,"
Muller said slowly as he smiled a rare smile.
"I don't think so," remarked Shit. "Swindon's spare shops is currently surrounded by more SO9 operatives and SWAT men than you can count in a month. Not even that madman Hades would try and get in here."
The smile dropped from Muller's lips.
"SO9 is the finest anti-terrorist squad on the planet," continued Chit. "We'll get him, you know. It's only a question of when. And if you help us, things might not look so bad in court for you."
Muller wasn't impressed.
"If your SO9 operatives are the best on the planet, how come it takes a 75-year-old literatech to arrest me?"
Jack Shit couldn't think of an answer to this. Muller turned to me.
"And if SO9 is so shit hot, why does this young lady have the best luck cornering Hades?"
"I got lucky," I replied, adding, "Why hasn't Martin Chuzzlewit been killed? It's not like Acheron to make idle threats."
"No, indeed," replied Muller. "No, indeed."
"Answer the question, Muller," said Shit pointedly. "I can make things very uncomfortable for you."
Muller smiled at him.
"Not half as uncomfortable as Acheron could. He lists slow murder, torture, and flower arranging as his hobbies in Witch Criminal."
"So you want to do some serious time?"
asked Hicks, who wasn't going to be left out of the interview.
"The way I see it, you're looking at quintuple life, or you could walk free in a couple of minutes. What's it to be?"
"Do as you will, officers. You'll get nothing out of me. No matter what, Hades will get me out."
Muller folded his arms and leaned back in the chair. There was a pause. Shit bent forward and switched off the tape recorder. He pulled a handkerchief out of his pocket and draped it across the video camera in the corner of the interview room. Hicks and I looked at one another nervously. Muller watched the proceedings, but didn't seem unduly alarmed.
"Let's try it again," said Shit, pulling out his automatic and pointing it at Muller's shoulder. "Where is Hades?"
Muller looked at him.
"You can kill me now, or Hades kills me later, when he finds I've talked. I'm dead either way, and your death is probably a great deal less painful than Acheron's. I've seen him at work. You wouldn't believe what he is capable of."
"I would," I said slowly. Chit released the safety on his automatic.
"I'll count to three."
"I can't tell you."
"One.
He'd kill me."
"Two."
I took my cue. "We can offer you protective custody."
"From him?" demanded Muller. "Are you completely nuts?"
"Three."
Muller closed his eyes and started to shake. Shit put the gun down. This wasn't going to work. Suddenly, I had a thought. "He doesn't have the manuscript anymore, does he?" Muller opened an eye and looked at me. It was the sign I'd been looking for.
"Mycroft destroyed it, didn't he?" I continued, reasoning as my uncle might have, and did.
"Is that what happened?"
asked Jack Shit. Muller said nothing.
"He'll be wanting to find an alternative," observed Hicks. "There must be thousands of original manuscripts out there," murmured Shit. "We can't cover them all. Which one is he after?"
"I can't tell you," stuttered Muller, his resolve beginning to leave him. "He'd kill me."
"He'll kill you when he finds out you told us that Mycroft destroyed the Chuzzlewit manuscript," I responded evenly.
"But I didn't."
"He's not to know.
We can protect you, Muller, but we need to capture Hades. Where is he?
Muller looked at us one by one.
Protective custody, he stammered.
It'll need a small army.
I can supply that, asserted Shit, using the truth with an economy for which he had become famous. The Goliath Corporation is prepared to be generous in this matter.
Okay, I'll tell you.
He looked at us all and wiped his brow, which had suddenly started to glisten.
Isn't it a bit hot in here? He asked.
No, replied Shit. Where's Hades?
Well, he's at the...
He suddenly stopped talking, his face contorted with fear as a violent spasm of pain hit his lower back, and he cried out in agony.
Tell us, quick!
Shouted Shit, leaping to his feet and grabbing the stricken man's lapels.
Pandaren!
He screamed.
He's at... Tell us more!
Roared Shit.
There must be 1,000 Pandarens!
Guess!
Screamed Muller.
Guess! Ah!
I'll not play your games!
Yelled Shit, shaking the man vigorously.
Tell me, or I'll kill you with my bare hands right now!
But Muller was now beyond rational thought, or Shit's threats. He squirmed and fell to the floor, writhing in agony.
Medic!
I screamed, dropping to the floor next to the convulsing Muller, whose open mouth screamed a silent scream as his eyes rolled up into his head. The smell of scorched clothes reached my nostrils. I leaped back as a bright orange flame shot out of Muller's back. It ignited the rest of him, and we all had to beat a hasty retreat as the intense heat reduced Muller to ash in under 10 minutes.
Damn,
muttered Shit when the acrid smoke had cleared. Muller was a heap of cinders on the floor. There wouldn't even be enough to identify him.
Hades, I murmured. Some sort of built-in safety device. As soon as Muller starts to blab, up he goes. Very neat.
You sound as if you almost respect him, Miss Next, observed Shit.
I can't help it, I shrugged. Like the shark, Acheron has evolved into the almost perfect predator. I've never hunted big game, and never would, but I can understand the appeal.
The first thing, I went on, ignoring the smoking pile of ash that had recently been Muller, is to treble the guards on any places where original manuscripts are held. After that, we want to start looking at anywhere called Pandaren.
I'll get on to it, said Hicks,
who had been looking for a reason to go for some time. Shit and I were left looking at one another.
Looks like we're on the same side, Miss Next.
Sadly, I replied disdainfully. You want the prose portal. I want my uncle back. Acheron has to be destroyed before either of us gets what we want. Until then, we'll work together.
A useful and happy union, replied Shit,
with anything but happiness on his mind. I pressed a finger to his tie.
Understand this, Mr. Shit. You may have might in your back pocket, but I have right in mine. Believe me when I say I will do anything to protect my family. Do you understand?
Shit looked at me coldly.
Don't try to threaten me, Miss Next. I could have you posted to the Lerwick Literatech office quicker than you can say Swift. Remember that. You're here because you're good at what you do. Same reason as me. We are more alike than you think. Good day, Miss Next.
A quick search revealed 84 towns and villages in Wales named Pandaren. There were twice as many streets and the same number again of pubs, clubs and associations. It wasn't surprising there were so many. Dick Pandaren had been executed in 1831 for wounding a soldier during the Merthyr riots. He was innocent, and so became the first martyr of the Welsh Rising,
and something of a figurehead for the Republican struggle. Even if Goliath could infiltrate Wales, they wouldn't know which Penderyn to start with. Clearly, this was going to take some time. Tired, I left to go home. I picked up my car from the garage, where they had managed to replace the front axle, shoehorn in a new engine, and repair the bullet holes, some of which had come perilously close. I rolled up at the Finnis Hotel as a Clipper-class airship droned slowly overhead. Dusk was just settling, and the navigation lights on either side of the huge airship blinked languidly in the evening sky. It was an elegant sight, the 10 propellers beating the air with a rhythmic hum. During the day, an airship could eclipse the sun. I stepped inside the hotel. The Milton conference was over, and Liz welcomed me now as a friend rather than a guest.
"Good evening, Miss Next. All well?"
"Not really," I smiled, "but thanks for asking."
"Your Dodo arrived this evening," announced Liz. "He's in Kennel 5. News travels fast. The Swindon Dodo fanciers have been up already. They said he was a very rare version 1 or something. They want you to call them."
"He's a 1.2, I murmured absently. Dodos weren't high on my list of priorities right now. I paused for a moment. Liz sensed my indecision.
"Can I get you anything? Has, Mr. Park Lane called?"
"No. Were you expecting him to?" "No, not really." "If he calls, I'm in the Cheshire Cat. If not, my room. If you can't find me, can you ask him to call again in half an hour?"
"Why don't I just send a car to fetch him?"
"Oh, God, is it that obvious?" Liz nodded her head. "He's getting married."
"But not to you?"
"No."
"I'm sorry to hear that."
"Me too. Has anyone ever asked you to marry them?"
"Sure."
"What did you say?"
"I said, ask me again when you get out."
"Did he?"
"No."
I checked in with Pickwick, who seemed to have settled in well. He made excited plock-plock noises when he saw me. Contradicting the theories of experts, Dodos had turned out to be surprisingly intelligent and quite agile. The ungainly bird of common legend was quite wrong. I gave him some peanuts and smuggled him up to my room under a coat. It wasn't that the kennels were dirty or anything. I just didn't want him to be alone. I put his favourite rug in the bath to give him somewhere to roost and laid out some paper. I told him I'd move him to my mother's the following day, then left him staring out of the window at the cars in the car park.
"Good evening, miss," said the barman at the Cheshire Cat. "Why is a raven like a writing desk?"
"Because there is a bee in both."
"Very good. Half of Vorpal's special, was it?"
"You must be kidding. Gin and tonic, a double." He smiled and turned to the optics.
"Police?"
"Special ops."
"Literatech?"
"Yep." I took my drink.
"I trained to be a literatech," he said wistfully. "Made it to cadetship."
"What happened?"
"My girlfriend was a militant Marlovian. She converted some will-speak machines to quote from Tamburlaine, and I was implicated when she was nabbed. And that was that. Not even the military would take me."
"What's your name?"
"Chris.
Thursday." We shook hands. "I can only speak from experience, Chris, but I've been in the military and special ops, and you should be thanking your girlfriend."
"I do," hastened Chris. "Every day. We're married now and have 2 kids. I do this bar job in the evenings and run the Swindon branch of the Kit Marlowe Society during the day. We have almost 4,000 members. Not bad for an Elizabethan forger, murderer, gambler and atheist."
"There are some who say he might have written the plays usually attributed to Shakespeare." Chris was taken aback. He was suspicious too.
"I'm not sure I should be discussing this with a literatech."
"There's no law against discussion, Chris.
Who do you think we are? The Thought Police?
No, that's SO2, isn't it?
But about Marlowe?
Chris lowered his voice.
OK. I think Marlowe might have written the plays. He was undoubtedly a brilliant playwright, as Faust, Tamburlaine and Edward II would attest. He was the only person of his age who could have actually done it. Forget Bacon and Oxford. Marlowe has to be the odds-on favourite.
But Marlowe was murdered in 1593,
I replied slowly.
Most of the plays were written after that.
Chris looked at me and lowered his voice.
Sure, if he died in the bar fight that day.
What are you saying?
It's possible his death was faked.
Why?
Chris took a deep breath. This was a subject he knew something about.
Remember that Elizabeth was a Protestant queen. Anything like atheism or papism would deny the authority of the Protestant Church and the Queen as the head.
Treason, I murmured.
A capital offence.
Exactly. In April 1593, the Privy Council arrested one Thomas Kidd in connection with some anti-government pamphleteering. When his rooms were searched, they revealed some atheistic writings.
So?
Kidd fingered Marlowe. Said Marlowe had written them 2 years ago when they were rooming together. Marlowe was arrested and questioned on May 18th, 1593. He was freed on bail, so presumably there wasn't enough evidence to commit him for trial.
What about his friendship with Walsingham?
I asked.
I was coming to that. Walsingham had an influential position within the Secret Service. They had known each other for a number of years. With more evidence arriving daily against Marlowe, his arrest seemed inevitable. But on the morning of May 30th, Marlowe is killed in a bar brawl, apparently over an unpaid bill.
Very convenient.
Very. It's my belief that Walsingham faked his friend's death. The three men in the tavern were all in his pay. He bribed the coroner and Marlowe set up Shakespeare as the front man. Will, an impoverished actor who knew Marlowe from his days at the Shoreditch Theatre, probably leaped at the chance to make some money. His career seems to have taken off as Marlowe's ended.
It's an interesting theory. But wasn't Venus and Adonis published a couple of months before Marlowe's death? Earlier even than Kidd's arrest?
Chris coughed.
Good point.
All I can say is that the plot must have been hatched somewhat ahead of time, or that records have been muddled. He paused for a moment, looked about, and lowered his voice further.
Don't tell the other Marlowians, but there is something else that points away from a faked death.
I'm all ears.
Marlowe was killed within the jurisdiction of the Queen's coroner. There were 16 jurors to view the supposedly switched body, and it is unlikely that the coroner could have been bribed. If I had been Walsingham, I would have had Marlowe's death faked in the boonies, where coroners were more easily bought. He could have gone farther and had the body disfigured in some way to make identification impossible.
What are you saying?
That an equally probable theory is that Walsingham himself had Marlowe killed to stop him talking. Men say anything when tortured, and it's likely that Marlowe had all kinds of dirt on Walsingham.
What then?
I asked.
How would you account for the lack of any firm evidence regarding Shakespeare's life, his curious double existence, the fact that no one seemed to know about his literary work in Stratford?
Chris shrugged.
I don't know, Thursday. Without Marlowe, there is no one else in Elizabethan London even able to write the plays.
Any theories?
None at all. But the Elizabethans were a funny bunch. Court intrigue, the Secret Service.
The more things change.
My point entirely. Cheers.
We clinked glasses and Chris wandered off to serve another customer. I played the piano for half an hour before retiring to bed. I checked with Liz, but Landon hadn't called.